Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today's kind of like a slightly different sort of episode. It's an episode I should have probably done some time ago, and it's just a kind of an issue I've been dealing with online for a while, and it's I did a YouTube video literally years ago explaining why the oft-cited idea that comes from the kind of like the often from the far right that Hitler was a socialist is incorrect and factually in kind of every conceivable way. Maybe it wasn't the greatest video I ever did, and looking at it with hindsight now, there's a whole bunch of other stuff I could and perhaps should have said, but anyway, consistently over about the last 10 years, the level of vitriol this one video has generated is fascinating. It really is. The level of engagement, I mean, I don't really put a lot of time and effort into the YouTube channel. It's, you know, a bit of an afterthought, to be honest with you. But the level of engagement this one video gets is really, really interesting. And the level of anger it generates kind of points to something very, 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 very interesting, and I want to kind of unpack and discuss that today. When I set this podcast up, this podcast is a complete accident, as so many things about my life are. And when I set this podcast up, it was for my students in a school that I have not taught in for many, many years, and, you know, I actually left teaching itself last year to work in counselling and psychotherapy, which is what I do. But over time, the kind of the purpose of the podcast became kind of apparent to me, and it was to try to create a sort of a useful filter on the internet for people who wanted to access peer-reviewed history. You know, when I talk about things, I either talk to a historian or I find a book that I've particularly thought was valuable and has something important and interesting to say, and most importantly is well evidenced and researched and all that kind of stuff. And so I can then present that to you guys who are listening as, look, this is interesting, this is important, this tells us something about the past. It kind of might even tell us something about the present moment. And so internet kind of conspiracy theories and this sort of misinformation that we are constantly having to deal with, and we'll only have to deal with more of, is kind of what I try to create a barrier against. It's virtually impossible, but I I think that this key issue is a very, very important one. Okay, to set out the kind of the case. So fascism, if we sort of leave Nazism aside, which you can sort of kind of call like a variant of fascism, if you go back to the eve of the First World War, slightly beforehand, maybe the five or six years before the First World War, when there are these sort of proto-fascist ideas emerging in all across Europe, from Russia to Italy, to France, and a little bit in Great Britain, but not particularly. These proto-fascist ideas were fixated on one key problem. What do you do about organised labour? How do you deal with the threat of organised labour and mass democracy? And fascist thinkers were agitating. They said, basically, if organised labour and mass democracy triumph, then you know the rule of the elites, or even just the rule of the bourgeoisie, that's gone. And the way in which you deal with this, and this is where various kind of ascetic movements came alongside and on board with all of this. The way you deal with this problem is you have the only individual you care about is the inspirational leader, the visionary strongman who will guide the way for the masses. The masses are, you know, pliable and stupid and ignorant, and they'll believe whatever you tell them. Fascism, when it started to be kind of crystallised after the First World War with people like Gabriel D'Annunzio, began to kind of articulate this, and a host of other ideas kind of gather amongst it. You know, the idea of the strong man, the leader, leading the nation, national destiny, national renewal, and that really kind of speaks to a desire for kind of revanchism in Italy and Germany, imperialism, taking back the territories that we thought were ours and we believe ours, such as the Irredenta lands that were promised to Italy by the Allied powers and were denied in the Treaty of Versailles, and then doing national hurts and humiliations and that kind of thing. And, you know, in Italian fascism, anti-Semitism doesn't particularly feature as a thing until, of course, Hitler and Mussolini become, after 1936, become particularly close. Obviously, in German fascism, in Nazism, anti-Semitism is a key part of that, and anti-Semitism is tied in with Hitler's obsession that kind of the Jews have somehow created Marxism. Now, this is my first part of my kind of Hitler was not a socialist, was not on the left thesis, that Hitler saw organised labour and socialism as the product of the Jews, and he believed that that racial stratification was the ordering of society, that you have dominant races and inferior ones, and the inferior ones serve the dominant races, or they're kind of wiped out when you take their lands and territories. And he looked at the fate of the Native Americans in the Great Plains of America, and said, well, yeah, that's what happens. You know, you sweep away the inferior peoples, and you know, and the Aryan peoples triumph. And this is how history is meant to go. He thought that Marx's idea of history, not that I think Hitler understood it particularly well, but he said that Marx's idea that all history is the history of class struggle, well, this is just a kind of a mischievous and dangerous idea that has been put there by this kind of Jewish philosopher, and of course Marx obviously was Jewish. And so fascism is an anti-socialism. It might have manifested itself in the term national socialism at a certain point, but it is anti-socialist in its ethos. Hitler had no intention of creating some sort of classless society. Even in his vision of a post-war Germany, of a racial utopia, there was to be class stratifications. Sure, you know, there was this idea that all Germans would be united by German blood, but those that toiled and worked would still, you know, be a proletariat. There would still be a capitalist class in Germany, and indeed there was. Now, one of the key arguments that's put over, or the claims that I see time and time again, is that Nazism is a kind of like a big state idea. It's a, and therefore, if we're looking down that road, then the kind of the far right claim of what socialism is statism. It's the state, which would make Britain and America during the Second World War socialist countries. These are countries that saw an enormous expansion in state power. That's a bit of a facetious point, but you see the point I'm making here. Statism alone doesn't dictate whether something is socialist or not. I mean, we exist in an age now where not necessarily far-right fascist arguments, but kind of right conservative arguments have become fundamentally libertarian, purely because conservative parties around the world are paid for by billionaires that don't want to pay any taxes. And so they cook up this sort of neoliberal stew of ideas that are popular, sort of pumped by right-wing think tanks into newspapers and TV programs and into political classes, saying that, you know, the and this goes back to kind of Thatcherite, Reaganite kind of era, that taxation and taxation is essentially theft, and the state is essentially bad, and it can't do anything, and can't get anything right, and only causes more problems, which is, you know, largely erroneous. Look at the, you know, coronavirus, for example. When we needed it, there we are. The state turns up when it's required. But not wanting to get bogged down in picking holes in Thatcherite ideas, though there are many to pick, I think that this current discourse comes from kind of that origin. It's about, you know, if you take Nazism, the most kind of repugnant and evil manifestation of you know, of humanity, there are some close contenders for awful regimes of the 20th century, but obviously Nazism is by far the kind of the most viscerally kind of monstrous, and you associate that with the notion of the state in general, or the idea that the state is fundamentally oppressive, or that a defining feature of something like Nazism is statism, then it's which, you know, it is a very, very kind of erroneous argument in itself. But then it means that you can then redefine Nazism as socialist, because we're saying that socialism is statism. Well, I mean, the extent to which Nazism and statism go together is a kind of a complicated one. Nazism, you know, from 1933 until, you know, the middle of the decade, just as the regime is establishing itself, there is a kind of a client-like relationship between Nazism and capital. The idea that Hitler was somehow like Stalin and, you know, nationalized German industry and collectivized the land, well, no, that's not an accurate description at all. German capital, if you look at the history of companies like IG Farben, was quite comfortable with Nazism. Nazism doesn't really need to expropriate German industry until the most kind of desperate phases of the war. During the Second World War, in Germany and in virtually every other combatant power, there has to be a kind of a degree of coordination. Aircraft manufacturers need to be told how many fighter planes to build, for example. Krupp have to be told how much steel to produce in order to make tanks, for example. But you find the equivalent in Britain and America. When Franklin Roosevelt wanted Boeing to build B-17 bombers, he offered them enormous sums of money, but there wasn't really the option of not making the B-17 bombers if they didn't wish to. You know, the same with kind of Liberty ships, or in Britain with Spitfires or Churchill tanks, or what have you. Global war demands statism. It demands an expansion of state power. That itself is not a defining feature of socialism. A defining, you know, if we're going to suggest that Hitler is a socialist, then we need to, you know, somehow prove that he read and endorsed Marx, that he believed in class struggle, that he believed that all history was the history of class struggle, and he didn't. Quite literally, there's some argument to suggest that he writes Mein Kampf as a kind of like a racial riposte to Marx, as a kind of a racialized response, saying that, well, you know, socialism as an idea has its manifesto, but we don't have our manifesto, and you know, Mein Kampf is a sort of an answer to that. Obviously, Mein Kampf is a very, very different book to Das Kapital or the Communist Manifesto, and it's far more kind of convoluted and rambling, and partly Hitler's kind of misremembered years in the war and his own opinions on things, and a sort of a very vague blueprint for how one might seize and wield power. But it contains nothing in it that can be argued as being objectively socialist. Unless, of course, you know, your intention is to wildly misread what socialist ideas are or have been. I mean, we may be approaching some kind of postmodern moment where, as a society, we decide that...
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The history of ideas don't really matter, and we can say that something is socialism or not, as we see fit. That would be, you know, a pretty alarming state of affairs, and our ability to kind of navigate ideas and to be able to kind of look objectively at what a set of ideas means would be hampered. But these things do happen. If you look at the way the term liberal has been used in the United States of America, liberal is used as a kind of a term of abuse by the political right, by, you know, Fox News and things like that, for anything which is sort of slightly left of, say, you know, Bill Clinton. But you know, liberal as we all know has nothing to do necessarily with the left. You mean you could describe Margaret Thatcher economically as a liberal. I mean, liberal sort of means this kind of idea, this set of ideas that emerged in you know, from perhaps the 17th to the 19th century, as states evolved and became kind of all powerful, about this essentially the limiting of state power and the rights of the individual. And it has nothing objectively to do with kind of left ideas at all, which is about the kind of, if you're going to maybe, and this is a very bold thing to do, but to encapsulate left ideas, you might encapsulate them as the essentially the ideas that pertain to the democratization of wealth and power. Those ideas, you know, if that's how we're going to see socialism, and obviously the people that don't like my YouTube channel probably aren't going to see it like that, but guys, if you're listening, here we go. Adolf Hitler had no desire whatsoever to democratize wealth and power. Adolf Hitler believed in elitism. His elitism was a racialized elitism, and in an era of European empires and kind of racial stratification of societies, dictatorial and democratic, he wasn't alone in those thoughts, but he absolutely believed in elites. He said, you know, the common man is not designed for power. The common man is not designed for thinking. You know, Hitler's view of himself, a very kind of inflated, arrogant, tortured genius view of himself, placed him kind of above, you know, the critical faculties of the common man in his thinking. But he had no belief in the, as I put it, the democratization of wealth and power. He believed that fundamentally the rot had set in with the French Revolution, and this was one of the most disastrous events that had ever happened in European history. In 1940, as his tanks rolled into Paris, he considered obliterating the city, obliterating the seat of the French Revolution, the birthplace of modern political thought, and certainly the birthplace of socialist ideas. In the end, he didn't obliterate Paris. He thought it would just kind of wither away into insignificance compared to the new Berlin that he was going to build. But his belief in that democracy itself would eventually lead to Marxism was a kind of a defining idea of Hitler's thought. He said, you know, if you let ordinary people vote, if you educate them, if you allow them to organise, you will eventually get the overthrow of capitalism. And whilst Hitler, you know, you can't describe him as a capitalist himself. Hitler had precious little interest in the establishment of the rule of capital. It certainly served him, but he saw it as kind of organically part of the natural order of things. But towards during the war and beforehand, Hitler believed that capital should be subservient not to a particular social class, not to the state, but should be subservient to the interests of the race. There is a moment where one of the directors of IG Farben went to see Hitler to say, we've lost, you know, our Jewish physicists cannot work. I think this would have been in 1933, probably, or slightly later, but our Jewish physicists cannot work, we need them. And Hitler exploded with anger and said, essentially, the German race doesn't need, you know, can do without physicists, and it certainly can do without Jewish ones. And he was telling the kind of the leaders of German capital that your interests are less important than the racial interests of the German people. Hitler's kind of an anti-intellectual. I mean, he believes himself to be an intellectual, but in terms of engaging with ideas. He doesn't think very much for them. He believes that will is the most important thing. And he certainly had no grasp of economics. His economic argument is one of plunder, essentially, that if you invade other countries and take their resources and wipe out lesser peoples or enslave them or do something with them, then you increase your country's economic capacity. And this is, he said, you know, look at America, that's what happened. The British in India, that's how they've become rich, and that's what you do. And so this is a brutally simple set of economic ideas. The fact that Hitler's kind of ethos was racial and imperial meant that Hitler was a kind of embracing ideas which were kind of antithetical to socialist thought. I mean, obviously both Marx and Lenin decried imperialism as this sort of like the pinnacle of capitalism, and saw it as kind of the ultimate expression of capitalist exploitation. When Hitler invaded Eastern Europe and then the West, one of some of the prime beneficiaries are a particular breed of kind of parasitic German capitalism, this sort of capitalism that thrives on cheap or slave labour, and it thrives on the conquest and theft of resources. I mean, the fact when you go to Auschwitz-Birkenau, the three month lifespan for the prisoners that weren't automatically murdered on arrival is one based on the extraction of labour. It's based on work. These were prisoners who were shipped out to work in factories or work cutting timber or a bunch of other menial stuff. At Auschwitz-Monowitz, just down the road, the Italian physicist Primo Levi worked, not physicist, I beg your pardon, chemist, worked there synthesizing rubber. The extraction of labour, of surplus labour value, for German industry really kind of suggests that far from being a socialist, one of Hitler's tasks was to suck resources, stolen resources, into Germany to give Germany this kind of economic unearned economic boostage. And some of the principal beneficiaries of this were German capital. Obviously, you know, they needed to survive the war in order to reap the kind of the benefits, and obviously they didn't do. Of course, in the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin, there are slave labor camps. Socialism also extracts labor, or at least kind of the Stalinist variety of it does. But obviously, the beneficiaries of that surplus labor value are not private industries. They are the apparatchiks of the Stalinist state. Okay, so I kind of rant coming to an end, really, and I don't even think of it as a rant. I think it's important to, from time to time, to stop and address how ideas are currently being used and what they are being used for, and to look at the kind of the connections to the past, and to kind of question whether what is being said makes any kind of meaningful sense, which of course it doesn't. Now, I'm fairly aware that the people that believe that Hitler was a socialist, and therefore socialism is a kind of code word for anything bad I don't like, will, you know, blithely ignore this, and that's fine. But I think it's important to kind of put forward a case for these ideas. and their kind of use and misuse. The final point to make, of course, this has always made it me, is like, well, Hitler called him the National Socialist Party. Don't you know what it stands for? It's the Nazi Party. Don't you know what it stands for? It's the National Socialist Party. Duh, there, I've got you. And so, well, yes, obviously, you know, it is the National Socialist Party. So how can you say Hitler isn't a socialist? Because socialism is an internationalist idea. What Hitler was saying, I mean, I think probably it sounded like the sort of thing that would be popular, and that's why they went for it. But if we look at it, if we imagine that Hitler gave it that slightly more thought, what he was saying is that the socialism, the kind of raising of living standards, the improvement of wages, would be a national project. It would be for those that we consider to be within the nation. So Aryan Germans, it excludes Jews, it excludes Gypsies, it excludes Poles, it excludes anyone that isn't of the Aryan blood. And Hitler very quickly tacked to the right. He abandoned any kind of redistributive idea from his manifesto, and in the first manifesto of the German Workers' Party, later to become the NSDAP, the Nazi National Socialist Party, there's virtually no mention of the redistribution of wealth whatsoever. But Hitler did see a redistribution of wealth in a different way, and he really believed that the looting and expropriation of the Jews would be how you would benefit Aryan Germans, because to him, not German capitalists, but German Jews were the exploiters and the parasites. And that ain't a socialist idea, it's a racist one, and one that we can put in the basket of ideas we call fascism. Okay, case rest for the prosecution. So, yeah, we'll return to normal service next week, but I felt after about 10 years of actually avoiding that question, because there's only so much mental bandwidth I have to talk to people who are going to kind of yell incoherently, we might as well address it, and there we go. So anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.